Phylon 4. After the latest warning from the head of MI5 about the serious and growing security threat in Britain, Richard Watson investigates the role of some radical Islamist groups and the methods they're using to get their message across.
1,600 people under surveillance, 30 terrorist plots. A stark warning last week from the security service MI5. But whose hands are moulding anger and resentment to create the British Jihad?
What role are you going to play? That's when you talk to yourself. Are you going to be one of the people who watch Osama bin Laden and the Mujahideen and the Duat in the UK fulfilling their duty and you sit back and watch? And you sit back and watch? No, my dear Muslim brothers, you need to play an active role. Why? Because Allah obliged you.
Phylon 4 investigates radicalisation over the internet, on university campuses and in criminal gangs, and uncovers alarming evidence which reveals how a minority of young British Muslims are being drawn into a life of extremism and crime.
I could see the anger in the guys. You can see their faces scrunching up. One of the guys is not right. We need to do something about this. We really need to do something to help our brothers. And then another guy, he just shouted it out, you know, like, I will kill them.
Each evening at around 9 p.m. in a quiet village in the West Country, Glenn Genby logs on to an internet chat room to listen to the Nashreen, motivational jihadi music played before members of the website come online and the night's events get underway. Sitting in the upstairs bedroom overlooking a full moon rising above the fields, he listens to lectures designed to groom the next generation of terrorist sympathisers.
We're looking at a chat room and we're looking at a particular Islamic room called Umatar Haq, and it's a cyber mosque.
Glenn Genvey is not part of Britain's professional security apparatus. He's one of a number of amateur detectives, computer hackers and ex-spies who work with the Vigil Group. Vigil, with members in Britain, Holland and the United States, aims to disrupt extremist activity by infiltrating radical groups and reporting back to the police and intelligence services. Tonight he's posing as a radical to gain access to the chat room. Roughly how many people are on this website chat room every night?
It can be anything from 10 to 60, but that doesn't mean it's the same members each night. So the membership could be much bigger than 60. From about May, I've been monitoring it virtually every night, and we've been recording each night. And some of the quotes that we've been getting are pretty hair-raising and are definitely incitement to acts of terror.
What sort of things have they been saying?
Basically a quote like, so the jihad fought by Al-Qaeda, fought by Osama bin Laden, fought by Sheikh Abu Zakawi, we are obliged to support them in every single way, however we can, physically, financially and verbally. They're openly supporting Al-Qaeda and openly supporting acts of terrorism.
The speaker tonight logs in using an alias, as do all visitors to the chat room. The preacher is British and is speaking from the UK. He's vitriolic about this country and about people of other faiths.
Obviously, there's no doubt about the occupying forces in Israel. We must hate them and be an enemy to them. Now, other Jews, what about them? Yes, we hate them as well. The fact that they are Jews, or the fact that they are Christians, or the fact that they are Hindus, or they are Sikhs, or the fact that they disbelieve in Allah, means we don't like them, we can never have any love for them.
But this is only the support act. Each night, the main speaker takes the microphone and broadcasts his message of hatred for the West. Here he is praising the brutal leader of the Iraqi insurgency, Abu Musab Zakawi.
Inshallah, tonight to speak about Sheikh Abu Musab Zakawi. And there's no doubt that he was a tiger and lions of Islam. Verily, he revived the sunnah of removing the head of the enemy. He revived the sunnah of slaughtering the enemy. He revived the sunnah of Muhammad Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam on strike the neck of the enemy. We saw him and his brothers how they removed the head of the enemy by their own sword. He is really fight with anything he got in his hand.
The voice belongs to Sheikh Omar Bakri Mohammed, who's been radicalising young British Muslims for 20 years without the authorities taking much notice at all. I recognise his voice from previous interviews, but because he uses various pseudonyms in the chat room, we double-checked his webcast with a leading voice recognition expert, Professor Peter French, who acts as a witness in both prosecution and defence cases. Professor French used a series of scientific tests to compare the material recorded from the internet with archive of a telephone call made by Bakri Mohammed.
When people from a foreign language background attempt to speak English, they make various errors of pronunciation. And what you tend to get are patterns which are rather idiosyncratic, rather personal to the individual. So if you listen here to a clip from the sermon.
And the enemy terrified from him.
His pronunciation of the word him, where it occurs at the end of an utterance. The vowel there, instead of being an I vowel, is more an U vowel, and the M is very pronounced. So if you listen here to a clip from the telephone recording.
Omar Bakri Mohammed, because of him.
Okay, I haven't carried out all these tests and haven't given due consideration to both the similarities and the differences found. My view was that these samples were consistent with having been spoken by the same person.
The British government hoped they'd heard the last of the radical preacher. When Bakri Mohammed left the UK after the London bombings, the Home Secretary moved against him, declaring his presence was no longer conducive to the public good. He's in exile in Lebanon, but he's still able to influence British recruits with, for example, his views on the London bombers.
Like when people said, do you condemn London bombers? I said, impossible. A'udhu billah, how we can condemn those great men? I think if there is man in the UK, those four bombers are the man. That's really what the way we take, look at it. It's not something bad, something so good. It's something so good to be involved in.
Vigil, the private group that infiltrated the chat room, say they test the preachers by joining in the question and answer sessions that follow the nightly sermons. On one such occasion, an undercover operative asked Bakri Mohammed whether Dublin Airport should be considered as a terrorist target because it's a transiting point for US troops going to Iraq. His answer appears to condone a terrorist attack.
Hit the target. It is very hard, and that issue must be understood. You see, your situation there, it is quite difficult. And therefore, the answer is within your own questions.
Vigil has monitored and recorded Bakri Mohammed's chat room every night. Dominic Whiteman, Vigil's spokesman, says that 100 hours of material has now been passed to the anti-terrorist police and the security service MI5.
It should not be allowed for an individual like Omar Bakri Mohammed to publicly exhort terrorism, which is what he's exhorting in UK followers.
He is broadcasting from Lebanon, I suppose, and so he would argue he's not breaking the law in this country.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not just Omar Bakri Mohammed who is, you know, preaching. There are guys who are based in the UK who are also preaching hatred and breaking some of the recent terror laws, glorifying terror. So we've got to be aware of who these guys are now and then deal with them now before they do spread.
Bakri Mohammed's supporters used to call themselves Al-Mahajirun. That organisation was banned last year, but its supporters' political philosophy remains unchanged. Democracy is a sin, the Queen, the government and the state are all enemies of Islam, and they wish to see Britain turned into an Islamic state under Sharia law. We suggested to Home Office Minister Tony McNulty that the government's intention of neutralising Bakri Mohammed has failed.
The Terrorism Act only secured royal assent Easter of this year, but we do and have to, quite rightly, keep these things always under review.
But the fact of the matter is, right now, you have little choice but to stand by and watch while Bakri Mohammed preaches to British citizens, maybe as many as 700.
We try and do as much as we can at working with European and wider international partners, because this is, in terms of the battle of ideas, in terms of the propaganda dimension to this campaign, a formidable and sophisticated enemy that we're dealing with. And I think people are starting to appreciate that on a European level and internationally, as well as simply within the UK. But you're right, with something as globalised, if you like, as the internet, then yes, we keep our legislation constantly under review in that regard, but we do need to work very closely with European and international partners.
Sheikh Bakri Mohammed deliberately uses an open-access chat room to find and radicalise new recruits. If the administrator thinks you're a sympathiser, then it's relatively easy to get online. But we've discovered that Bakri Mohammed supporters use another, much more secretive website, which is crucial to the group. Now, one of the investigators who's been looking at this site has given me a password and a username which should allow me to get in. I'm now going to type in his secret password. There it is. I'm going to hit return now and see if we can actually get inside the website. Yep, it's loading up now. And we're into the main forum with Islamic community news, general discussions and the like. This members-only site, mantada.aswj.net, contained an advertisement for a forthcoming demonstration. It called on supporters to protest against the trial of an Islamist radical accused of incitement to murder for carrying placards about the Danish newspaper cartoons, which some say insulted Mohammed. "Honour of Mohammed on trial," proclaimed the advert. "Demonstration from 1 to 4pm outside the Old Bailey." Sure enough, at the prescribed time, about 20 radicals showed up. There were violent scuffles with the police and four men were arrested. This is striking evidence of how Bakri Mohammed supporters organised their campaign on the closed website.
This is what the Muslim community faces in this country. If we cannot express our views, if we cannot call for the Sharia, if you are arrested at demonstrations, then why does it surprise you that you have 7-7s and 9-11s in this country?
This was not the only lead we followed up on the members-only website. 3 weeks ago, a woman calling herself Terror, the mother of terror, posted an advertisement for a debate. It was billed as the true word of God, Bible versus the Koran. But underneath the poster was a chilling call to action. "Arise, the blood of the martyrs is calling you," it said. It gave an address and a time and a date for the meeting, so we decided to follow up the lead. The advert led us to the student campus at the University of Staffordshire in Stoke-on-Trent. The title of the debate sounded innocuous enough, but why had it been advertised on an extremist website? We sent a BBC investigator into the meeting.
When I arrived at that meeting, it was full of people who were only Muslims. There were 50 people in there, and there was just one lone Catholic priest. The Muslim guest speaker was very curious because he just got up and said, "I don't have to tell you who I am. I am Muslim, that should be enough." I definitely got the impression that he did not want to reveal his true identity, whatever the reasons may be.
And was this sort of reasoned debate? How would you characterize what happened next?
I would say that this was sort of Bible bashing exercise. The audience was laughing at excerpts from the Bible he had taken and he was discussing. He was just making a laughing stock of the Christianity.
What did you find out about the person who booked the room?
What I found out was there was this woman who used a different name when she spoke to me on the telephone before the talk. And when I met her, she used that name. But later on, when I went to the meeting, I found out that she had a different name. And it was confirmed later on by her on an email to me. She was definitely using a subterfuge.
Arguing against the Bible was a man we now know is called Abu Ratib, dressed in long white robes. The Catholic priest, the lone Christian voice at the meeting, told me his words reminded him of left-wing radicals from militant tendency. His instinct was a good one, since we've discovered that Abu Ratib is an Islamist radical from Luton, who's come into conflict with senior members of the mainstream central mosque for distributing leaflets about jihad. He's been linked to Omar Bakri Mohammed's group, Al Mahajroon, though he denies having been a member. But judging by one of his speeches on the internet, he believes Al-Qaeda is Islamically justified. We asked Staffordshire University whether they knew about his background. We were told that the meeting was organised with the full knowledge of the university chaplain and no extremist views were promoted. But a spokeswoman confirmed they knew nothing about his track record.
The university is obviously concerned to learn of reports that this debate was advertised on an extremist website, and this is subject to investigation. We will work with students, the students' union, the police and local communities to encourage even greater vigilance and actively prevent Staffordshire University being used as a platform by extremists.
But Abu Ratib's presence at Staffordshire University raises a broader question. Do universities know enough about the people invited onto campus to lecture students?
As we've just come out fresh from the blessed and Mubarak month of Ramadan,
Sheikh Musa Admani delivers the Friday lecture at London Metropolitan University. A leading moderate thinker, he was the first imam to be appointed to a British campus. He's had to confront radicals at London Met from Al-Mahajroon and Hizbut Tahrir, another Islamist group which aims to create a global Islamic state. When he tried to control outside speakers from coming onto campus by insisting they had to discuss faith, not politics, and be Islamically qualified, things got very nasty indeed.
Threats were on many occasions, not only in the university, but also outside as well. I mean, I'd received threats in the community centre. Somebody came up and opened the door and then started shouting and screaming and wanted to hit. I said, you can abuse me, you can say anything you want. If you touch me, then I'll call the police. Another man told me a number of students from Imperial College were coming to kill me on a Friday.
Sheikh Musa Admani has been trying to alert the government to the problem of radicalization on British university campuses since 2003. Back then, he noticed a surge of extremism, with some Islamic societies taken over by radicals. He came up with a plan, government-backed training for a force of trained moderate imams to enter universities to take on the extremists at their weakest point, on their knowledge of Islam and the Quran. Phylon 4 has seen correspondence to ministers dating back 3 years.
I was invited to meet the Minister of Education and the Home Office Minister then, 3 years ago, and they took my report and very politely and thanked me, and that was the end of the story. Never heard anything from them since.
Nothing?
No.
3 years ago?
Yes. Perhaps the interest was not there, I don't know.
Musa Admani knows of 4 other universities which have serious problems with extremists, so we decided to try to find out more by sending Freedom of Information Act requests to 66 universities. We asked them whether they'd had meetings about Islamist extremism generally, or about a list of radical groups including Al-Mahajroon. Their responses show that not a single minuted meeting has been held anywhere in the country, and 63 out of 66 universities have not offered any advice to staff or students at all. But Professor Drummond Bone from the body which represents universities, Universities UK, denies they're underestimating the threat.
I think it's the wrong question. I think if you'd asked for minutes about extremism or illegal behaviour on campus, you would have actually found minutes. You also asked questions about individual groups of Islamic extremists, some of which, I say, are no longer exist, some of which are banned. And again, it doesn't surprise me there are no minutes about that, because that's not the kind of discussion that you would have minuted. I suspect that security officers at universities have spoken to special branch, have spoken to the local police, if that kind of activity was taking place.
Not to minute the meeting implies to me there's a lack of a policy in universities on these issues.
No, there is no lack of a policy. Every university will have a policy on extremism and on illegal behaviour and incitement to violence on campus. I can say that really with some certainty.
Communities Minister Ruth Kelly has called on universities to do more, and the recent public debate about radicalisation has centred on this. But Phylon 4 has uncovered startling evidence about radicalisation on a different front. Our research around Croydon in South London reveals an alarming crossover between Islamist extremism, gangs and crime. Several gangs in the area are using Islam as a cover for violence against non-believers known as the Kafar. Gypset Taliban and the Muslim Boys are two of the most powerful. We're told that children as young as 12 are being targeted, and extremists are even handing out literature in schools. Young people who spend time on the streets know what's going on at one local sixth form college.
Going to college in South London area, you might see people handing out leaflets and tapes and stuff like that. At the college, they were trying to convert people in the college, yeah.
Actually on the college premises?
Yeah, around the college area, people would try to convert other students, yeah.
And where would they do this?
Don't have an idea where this place is, but it's probably near the prayer room or something, I don't know.
I mean, let me just get straight. Your understanding was that there was a place on the college campus where they were trying to convert people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I understand. Yeah.
Basically, it was around like 9/11 times where people started converting up in Brixton and it started moving down to Streatham. Then it came down to here, to see, and people here started converting. They think that they're in the winning team, really.
The winning team?
Yeah, that's a statement that I can say I've heard from a Muslim before. I'm in the winning team.
Have any of your friends been approached to convert?
Plenty.
For some kids, conversion to Islam is all about dress sense and the gang, but others are willing to go much further. Camilla Batman-Geller, who runs the charity Kids Company, has close links with vulnerable children in South London, some of whom are involved in crime. She says in the search for approval and belonging, some may present a real threat.
The dangerous element is that a lot of these really vulnerable young people are being paid for by certain mosques to go abroad to Afghanistan, Pakistan, and some are going legitimately to learn Arabic, to learn how to read the Quran better. But some are being recruited into training camps in order to adopt a jihadist mentality.
Have you seen hard evidence of that yourself?
Yeah, I've had to actually stop young men from going. I've had to turn up at airport, stop young men. I actually had to take two young men away and go through the Quran with them and explain to them that what they're being taught isn't quite what's in the Quran. But it's lucky because I have a background in Islamic thinking, so I was able to do that. But for a lot of these young people who are completely isolated and don't have anyone to give them a contradictory view, it's very difficult.
I'm on a rooftop in the middle of South London. To the north, I can see the London Eye on the bank of the Thames. To the south is the high ground of Crystal Palace and Croydon, where gang violence is becoming a problem. We've heard accounts of vicious street fights with as many as 50 youths on each side, some using knives, swords and guns. There have been cases where young men have been attacked for being non-believers or kafir.
My son was shot 5 times in the head. He died immediately. It's very sad as a mother to actually see a 20-year-old son that was a healthy young man being laid 6'6" under. It's painful, very, very painful.
The young man's mother explains how her son was shot dead in a local park. But perhaps the most shocking aspect of this case is the reason why he was killed.
So I do believe it was a Muslim gang member. He came outside my house and he told my son that if he didn't become a Muslim by the Wednesday, that he would be murdered. And he was murdered. So I am inclined to feel that it was them.
And how do you know that?
My son told me that they'd threatened him. And they wanted him to become one of their gangs. And he refused point blank to do so. And this is what they go around and do. They intimidate young men to become Muslims, and if they don't, they're threatened. So this is what is going on in our society. There is a very, very, very serious problem out there with the Muslim gangs on the streets.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
One of the men suspected of being involved in the shooting was arrested outside Croydon Mosque. He was found to be in possession of a loaded gun and was jailed for 8 years for possession of a firearm and robbery, but the murder charge was dropped. We don't know if the gunman had been radicalised by any particular group, but the mosque in Croydon has been the centre for extremist activity in the past, most notably from two organisations, Al-Mahajroon and Hizb ut-Tahrir. Hizb ut-Tahrir likes to present itself as a peaceful organisation that engages in intellectual debate, but the mosque management see it rather differently.
Hizb ut-Tahrir and other organisations with extreme tendencies represent a threat to society in terms of being a stop on community relations. It is not going too far to suggest that these organisations are actually a tumour on community relations.
Shoaib Youssef is one of the trustees. He says Hizb ut-Tahrir radicals had set their own agenda, telling people there were aspects about British life that were not Islamic, and integration with British society is contrary to the faith.
It was an open secret that Croydon Mosque and Islamic Centre were a meeting point, on Fridays especially, for Hizb ut-Tahrir and other organisations. We had up to 100 people attending these meetings. Now, these were essentially youth, and speakers who were not authorized by the mosque would come along and start delivering a lecture. Now, these lectures were essentially started off on a religious theme where they would explore aspects of the Quran. But then they would tend to veer off on a tangent, and other political aspects would then be explored. Some of the Quranic interpretation that was being put out was not entirely right, and this was actually confirmed on several occasions by the Imam and the Mufti at the mosque, that the interpretation that is actually being put on some of the verses in the Quran are actually quite extreme and not mainstream at all.
In an attempt to assert control, the mosque management and the religious leader or Mufti had to physically expel some Hizb ut-Tahrir followers. There were scuffles, and on one occasion an elder was pushed to the floor. Notices inside the mosque now make it clear that no political meetings are allowed, but outside the radicals still make their presence felt.
Unveiling the bush and Blair's war on Islam. Defending Islam in the true way, brothers. Bringing the correct arguments to the media and to the politicians.
There's a guy in the mosque who clearly doesn't want you guys out here. He thinks you're causing trouble.
No
what
comment.
Do you say to that?
No comment.
Well, you're causing trouble. The truth of the matter is they don't want you here, do they?
No comment.
You're not willing to accept?
Leave me.
Huh?
No,
don't. Easy, man. So what's the problem? But you're too. Hang on a second. Gently. Hey. When we try to ask questions, one supporter of the peaceful organisation interested in intellectual debate punches the cameraman I'm with. The police step in.
Can we try and keep it quiet? It's obviously a mosque. We don't want any incidents outside a mosque.
The mosque committee is clear they want nothing to do with extremists or those seeking to recruit Muslim youths for political causes. That's why the committee agreed to allow trustee Shuaib Youssef to speak with us about the fight they've had with Hizb ut-Tahrir.
There have been instances of gang warfare on the streets outside the mosque.
Muslim gangs?
Yes. There have been instances where the police have had to be called. People have been admitted to hospital. I mean, swords have been used. People slashed across the face.
Who do you think's involved?
We have no evidence that any extreme organization, Al-Muhajirun or HT or anyone else, has actually been recruiting thugs in the area. However, the same faces do seem to crop up, sometimes distributing leaflets or being involved in some of the incidences that have happened outside the mosque.
With the gangs?
With the gangs, yes.
So some of the people distributing leaflets you've seen in the gangs?
There have been instances when this has happened, yes.
This account is supported by one of the founding members of the mosque, who told us his friend's son was beaten for refusing to join the gang of Hizb ut-Tahrir supporters. Hizb ut-Tahrir wouldn't be interviewed for this programme, but in a statement issued through their lawyers, they said their members had tried to stop a fight between gangs outside the mosque in September this year. They said it was wholly wrong to suggest they were involved in the violence. But Phylon 4 has had exclusive access to an undercover mole who spent the past 6 months inside Hizb ut-Tahrir. His evidence paints a damning portrait of some of its activities in South London. We'll call him Jay. He's been recruited to a small cell as an apprentice member with four other recruits. Their teacher is known as a mashrif.
I had to swear my loyalty to Hizb ut-Tahrir face to face in front of a certain group you were with.
So this was swearing an allegiance in front of the five or so people?
Yeah, and after that, that's it.
What sort of people are these? I mean, Hizb ut-Tahrir has a reputation for being, for recruiting university students, graduates, intellectuals. Were they these kind of people?
No. These are the type of guys you see in the streets and you walk across the street because you don't want to cross their path. These are the people that go around the streets and if they feel like it, if they see you, they'll beat you up. Because, you know, you're a non-believer.
What did they say about the non-believers?
They're worthless. They're honestly worthless, you know. The non-believers are people that do not deserve living. The non-believers are just completely less than us. We are above everybody else.
Jay's cell, or Kalaka, was very secretive. Members never publicly acknowledged each other in the mosque, only in private houses where their teacher would hold talks. Jay says he began to realise his cell was being encouraged to bond and prove loyalty by using violence and crime.
They told me, you know, you really have to show your loyalty. You really have to show what you're made of. They told me, Allah tells you to go and intimidate those three boys across the street. What you have to do is you have to get money off them. And I was like, you know how? They're non-believers. They're nothing to us. You have the right to do that. You have the right to take what they have. So I went up to the guys. All right, I need some food. All right, and so to stop making trouble, and if you see the guys across the street, they're with me. I need £3 from you, £3 from you, £3 from you, and I want nothing to hear from you but just the £3 from you right now. The guys obviously laughed. And then the boys also started crossing the street, and when they saw that we were serious about it, and they got really scared.
They gave the money?
Yeah, they did.
So the brothers in your cell, your group, were testing you to see if you were willing to effectively commit a crime?
Yeah, they were.
Do you think this sort of criminal activity is directed from above? Is it agreed? Is it understood by the Mashrif that this goes on? Or do you think it's just a couple of lads out of control in your group?
No, not at all. It was mentioned to him, I was really pleased.
Is there any doubt in your mind that this is Hizbuk Tahrir?
These people are Hizbuk Tahrir. I swore my allegiance to Hizbuk Tahrir and tapes and all the audio stuff and everything had Hizbuk Tahrir all over it.
A few weeks ago, Jay was told to go to a house near Croydon. He was welcomed warmly by the others in his cell and the teacher from Hizbuk Tahrir. The Mashrif, saying this was a special night, played a video purporting to show the mistreatment of prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay.
It showed the way they've been treated, the prisoners. It was really graphic, extremely graphic actually. One of the bits I remember exactly is was this guy tied up to the chair, and this lady, white lady, she was across the desk. She started asking him questions. Meanwhile, that was happening, she literally started stripping down, taking her clothes off and getting closer to him. It's just such a degrading thing to happen. Then they show different scenes, how prisoners get treated. They get chained down and they get pig's blood all over them, all that stuff, you know. But you can tell it wasn't really the truth.
While they were watching the video, the Mashrif scrutinized his pupils to see whether the propaganda was having the desired effect.
I could see the guys. I could see the anger in the guys. You can see their faces scrunching up, apart from just being, wow, you know, that's nasty, or whatever. You can feel the anger. I saw one of the guys tying up his fist because of the way one of his brothers were treated. One of the guys is not right. We need to do something about this. We really need to do something to help our brothers. These non-believers, they do not deserve to be treating our kind this way. They're nothing. They're worthless. And then another guy, he just shouted it out, you know, like, I'll kill them, you know, I'll kill them, you know. And most of the guys were really pretty worked up. They really believed it.
Do you think, from what you've seen then, that some of these young men who've been recruited, after watching material like that, are capable, or could be capable, of becoming terrorists?
Yeah, I think that these guys will be willing to go all the way.
Just as we thought our investigation was complete, we discovered there's a sting in the tail to the story in South London. 2 weeks ago, police received a tip-off from another source in Hizbuk Tahrir. This time, things were very serious. That source had got wind of a plot on Guy Fawkes Night to firebomb a local synagogue near Croydon, and knew where the plotters had stashed materials for the attack. When we went to the synagogue to investigate, plainclothes police approached us within minutes, and the lead officer confirmed that an investigation is underway. Shadow Minister for Homeland Security Patrick Mercer believes this and other evidence makes the case for banning Hizbuk Tahrir strong.
It's a serious threat to the UK. It's subversive. It attempts to suborn and to radicalise. It's enough of a threat for the Prime Minister in 2005 to say that it should be banned. We've got to close them down, we've got to root them out, and we cannot tolerate them. It's dangerous. We've got to get it off the streets.
Again, we would have liked to interview Hizbuk Tahrir, but they declined. In their statement, they said,
"We are a non-violent organisation that has worked for over 10 years in Britain. We do not advocate or otherwise promote the use of violence or any criminal activity against civilians in the UK or anywhere else in the world. To suggest that Muslim organisations such as ours, rather than the government's policies, have created anger within the Muslim community is disingenuous and irresponsible.
We can't be sure whether Hizb ut-Tahrir's leaders know about alleged criminal activities of supporters in South London. It's possible they're the work of a splinter group which is out of control. But the organisation came very close to being outlawed last year. After the London bombings, the Prime Minister said he wanted to ban them, and the Home Office told us this is still under review. Any evidence of wrongdoing by the group or its supporters will weigh heavily against them. We put our findings to Home Office Minister Tony McNulty.
The case for proscribing Hizb ut-Tahrir is currently under review. It has been since the summer. And if we think we need to take action in that regard under our prescription orders, then we shall do.
We have spoken to a confidential source inside Hizb ut-Tahrir who tells us that his Hizb ut-Tahrir teacher, called a mashrif, has told him that the kafir, the non-believers, are worthless. You can do anything to them. You can rob them from them. You can steal from them. What is your reaction to that kind of sentiment from an organisation such as Hizb ut-Tahrir?
Well, I don't agree with that kind of sentiment. If there is any evidence of illegality, propagating terrorism, glorifying terrorism from any quarter, from any organisation, then it's evidence that I would value being passed on to the authorities. And that can go to the whole issue and decision-making process we have when it comes to looking to proscribe organisations.
But this is almost a year, I think, after Tony Blair suggested they should be banned.
Absolutely. Of many of the other organisations he referred to in his comments in August 2005, two of those three have been banned. It's not a process that we can do of our own volition because we don't like the particular brand of what a particular group is saying. We do need to substantiate, as appropriate under the rule of law, that this is an organisation that is on the wrong side of a line that seeks to propagandise on behalf of terrorists and glorify terrorism and savage events like the 7th of July.
Well, our evidence is pretty clear on that. If we hand it to you, will you investigate?
I shall certainly look into any evidence you provide me on that or any of the other matters, happily.
The reporter in this week's File on 4 was Richard Watson, and the programme was produced in Manchester by David Lewis. Next week, Jerry Northam asks why phone tap evidence can't be used in British courts. Organisation that engages in intellectual debate, but the mosque management see it rather differently.
Hizb ut-Tahrir and other organisations with extreme tendencies represent a threat to society in terms of being a stop on community relations. It is not going too far to suggest that these organisations are actually a tumour on community relations.
Shoaib Youssef is one of the trustees. He says Hizb ut-Tahrir radicals had set their own agenda, telling people there were aspects about British life that were not Islamic, and integration with British society is contrary to the faith.
It was an open secret that Croydon Mosque and Islamic Centre were a meeting point on Fridays especially for Hizb ut-Tahrir and other organisations. We had up to 100 people attending these meetings. Now, these were essentially youth and speakers who were not authorised by the mosque would come along and start delivering a lecture. Now, these lectures were essentially started off on a religious theme where they would explore aspects of the Quran. But then they would tend to veer off on a tangent and other political aspects would then be explored. Some of the Quranic interpretation that was being put out was not entirely right, and this was actually confirmed on several occasions by the Imam and the Mufti at the mosque, that the interpretation that is actually being put on some of the verses in the Quran are actually quite extreme and not mainstream at all.
In an attempt to assert control, the mosque management and the religious leader or Mufti had to physically expel some Hizb ut-Tahrir followers. There were scuffles, and on one occasion an elder was pushed to the floor. Notices inside the mosque now make it clear that no political meetings are allowed, but outside the radicals still make their presence felt.
Unveiling the bush and Blair's war on Islam. Defending Islam in the true way, brothers. Bringing the correct arguments to the media and to the politicians.
There's a guy in the mosque who clearly isn't one of you guys out here. He thinks you're causing trouble. What do you say to that?
No comment.
Well, you're causing trouble. The truth of the matter is they didn't want you here, did they?
No comment.
You're not willing to engage?
Me.
Huh?
You don't.
So what's the problem? But you're. Hang on a second.
Me.
No, gently. Hey. When we try to ask questions, one supporter of the peaceful organisation interested in intellectual debate punches the cameraman I'm with. The police step in.
Can we try and keep it quiet? It's obviously a mosque. We don't want any incidents outside a mosque.
The mosque committee is clear they want nothing to do with extremists or those seeking to recruit Muslim youths for political causes. That's why the committee agreed to allow trustee Shoaib Youssef to speak with us about the fight they've had with Hizb-ut Tahrir.
There have been instances of gang warfare on the streets outside the mosque.
Muslim gangs?
Yes. There have been instances where the police have had to be called. People have been admitted to hospital. I mean, swords have been used, people slashed across the face.
Who do you think's involved?
We have no evidence that any extreme organisation, Al-Muhajirun or HT or anyone else, has actually been recruiting thugs in the area. However, the same faces do seem to crop up, sometimes distributing leaflets or being involved in some of the incidences that have happened outside the mosque.
With the gangs?
With the gangs, yes.
So some of the people distributing leaflets you've seen in the gangs?
There have been instances when this has happened, yes.
This account is supported by one of the founding members of the mosque, who told us his friend's son was beaten for refusing to join the gang of Hizb-ut Tahrir supporters. Hizb-ut Tahrir wouldn't be interviewed for this program, but in a statement issued through their lawyers, they said their members had tried to stop a fight between gangs outside the mosque in September this year. They said it was wholly wrong to suggest they were involved in the violence. But Phylon 4 has had exclusive access to an undercover mole who spent the past 6 months inside Hizb-ut Tahrir. His evidence paints a damning portrait of some of its activities in South London. We'll call him Jay. He's been recruited to a small cell as an apprentice member with four other recruits. Their teacher is known as a mashrif.
I had to swear my loyalty to Hizb-ut Tahrir face to face in front of certain groups you were with.
So this was swearing an allegiance in front of the five or so people?
Yeah, and after that, that's it.
What sort of people are these? I mean, Hizb-ut Tahrir has a reputation for being... for recruiting university students, graduates, intellectuals. Were there these kind of people?
No. These are the type of guys you see in the streets and you walk across the street because you don't want to cross that path. These are the people that go around the streets and if they feel like it, if they see you, they'll beat you up because, you know, you're a non-believer.
What did they say about the non-believers?
They're worthless. They're honestly worthless, you know. The non-believers are people that do not deserve living. The non-believers are just completely less than us. We are above everybody else.
Jay's cell, or kalaka, was very secretive. Members never publicly acknowledged each other in the mosque, only in private houses where their teacher would hold talks. Jay says he began to realise his cell was being encouraged to bond and prove loyalty by using violence and crime.
They told me, you know, you really have to show your loyalty. You really have to show what you're made of. They told me, Allah tells you to go and intimidate those three boys across the street. What you have to do is you have to get money off them. And I was like, you know how? They're non-believers. They're nothing to us. You have the right to do that. You have the right to take what they have. So I went up to the guys. All right, I need some food. All right, and so to stop making trouble, and if you see the guys across the street, they're with me. I need £3 from you, £3 from you, £3 from you, and I want nothing to hear from you but just the £3 from you right now. The guys obviously laughed. And then the boys also started crossing the street, and when they saw that we were serious about it, and they got really scared.
They gave the money?
Yeah, they did.
So the brothers in your cell, your group, yeah, were testing you to see if you were willing to effectively commit a crime?
Yeah, they were.
Do you think this sort of criminal activity is directed from above? Is it agreed? Is it understood by the mashrif that this goes on? Or do you think it's just a couple of lads out of control in your group?
No, not at all. It was mentioned to him, I was really pleased.
Is there any doubt in your mind that this is Hizb-ut Tahrir?
These people are Hizb-ut Tahrir. I swore my allegiance to Hizb-ut Tahrir and tapes and all the audio stuff and everything had his battery all over it.
A few weeks ago, Jay was told to go to a house near Croydon. He was welcomed warmly by the others in his cell and the teacher from Hizb-ut Tahrir. The mashrif, saying this was a special night, played a video purporting to show the mistreatment of prisoners held at Guantanamo Bay.
It showed the way they've been treated the prisoners. He was really graphic, extremely graphic actually. One of the bits I remember exactly is was this guy tied up to the chair, and this lady, white lady, she was across the desk. She started asking him questions. Meanwhile, that was happening, she literally started stripping down, taking her clothes off and getting closer to him. It's just such a degrading thing to happen. And then they show different scenes, how prisoners get treated. They get chained down and they get pigs blood all over them, all that stuff, you know. But you can tell it wasn't really the truth.
While they were watching the video, the Mashrif scrutinized his pupils to see whether the propaganda was having the desired effect.
I could see the guys. I could see the anger in the guys. You can see their faces scrunching up, apart from just being, wow, you know, that's nasty or whatever. You can feel the anger. I saw one of the guys tying up his fist because of the way one of his brothers were treated. One of the guys is not right. We need to do something about this. We really need to do something to help our brothers. These non-believers, they do not deserve to be treating our kind this way. They're nothing. They're worthless. And then another guy, he just shouted it out, you know, like, I'll kill them, you know, I'll kill them, you know. And most of the guys were really pretty worked up. They really believed it.
Do you think, from what you've seen then, that some of these young men who've been recruited, after watching material like that, are capable, or could be capable, of becoming terrorists?
Yeah, I think that these guys will be willing to go all the way.
Just as we thought our investigation was complete, we discovered there's a sting in the tail to the story in South London. 2 weeks ago, police received a tip-off from another source in Hizb ut-Tahrir. This time, things were very serious. That source had got wind of a plot on Guy Fawkes Night to firebomb a local synagogue near Croydon, and knew where the plotters had stashed materials for the attack. When we went to the synagogue to investigate, plainclothes police approached us within minutes, and the lead officer confirmed that an investigation is underway. Shadow Minister for Homeland Security Patrick Mercer believes this and other evidence makes the case for banning Hizb ut-Tahrir strong.
It's a serious threat to the UK. It's subversive. It attempts to suborn and to radicalise. It's enough of a threat for the Prime Minister in 2005 to say that it should be banned. We've got to close them down, we've got to root them out, and we cannot tolerate them. It's dangerous, we've got to get it off the street.
Again, we would have liked to interview Hizb ut-Tahrir, but they declined. In their statement they said,
"We are a non-violent organisation that has worked for over 10 years in Britain. We do not advocate or otherwise promote the use of violence or any criminal activity against civilians in the UK or anywhere else in the world. To suggest that Muslim organisations such as ours, rather than the government's policies, have created anger within the Muslim community is disingenuous and irresponsible."
We can't be sure whether Hizb ut-Tahrir's leaders know about alleged criminal activities of supporters in South London. It's possible they're the work of a splinter group which is out of control. But the organisation came very close to being outlawed last year. After the London bombings, the Prime Minister said he wanted to ban them, and the Home Office told us this is still under review. Any evidence of wrongdoing by the group or its supporters will weigh heavily against them. We put our findings to Home Office Minister Tony McNulty.
The case for prescribing Hizb ut-Tahrir is currently under review. It has been since the summer. And if we think we need to take action in that regard under our prescription orders, then we shall do.
We have spoken to a confidential source inside Hizb ut-Tahrir who tells us that his Hizb ut-Tahrir teacher, called a Mashrif, has told him that the kafar, the non-believers, are worthless. You can do anything to them. You can rob them from them. You can steal from them. What is your reaction to that kind of sentiment from an organisation such as Hizb ut-Tahrir?
Well, I don't agree with that kind of sentiment. If there is any evidence of illegality, propagating terrorism, glorifying terrorism from any quarter, from any organisation, then it's evidence that I would value being passed on to the authorities. And that can go to the whole issue and decision-making process we have when it comes to looking to prescribe organisations.
But this is almost a year, I think, after Tony Blair suggested they should be banned.
Absolutely. Of many of the other organisations he referred to in his comments in August 2005, two of those three have been banned. It's not a process that we can do of our own volition because we don't like the particular brand of what a particular group is saying. We do need to substantiate, as appropriate under the rule of law, that this is an organisation that is on the wrong side of a line that seeks to propagandise on behalf of terrorists and glorify terrorism and savage events like the 7th of July.
Well, our evidence is pretty clear on that. If we hand it to you, will you investigate?
I shall certainly look into any evidence you provide me on that or any of the other matters, happily.
The reporter in this week's File on 4 was Richard Watson, and the programme was produced in Manchester by David Lewis. Next week, Jerry Northam asks why phone tap evidence can't be used in British courts.